There were actually six cases involved. There were two cases that were filed the day after San Francisco started issuing same-sex marriage licenses. We filed a lawsuit on behalf of Proposition 22 Legal Defense and Education Fund against the City and County of San Francisco. And Campaign for California Families filed a lawsuit that same day. The other four lawsuits were all filed after the Supreme Court stopped the issuing of marriage licenses on March 11, 2004. And I think it was the next day that the City and County of San Francisco and the Wu parties filed their lawsuit. Shortly thereafter, the Clinton parties filed their lawsuit, and the Tyler parties filed their lawsuit against Los Angeles. Those six cases were coordinated in the trial court. Each of them kept their own case number. On appeal, they were consolidated. The Court of Appeal consolidated them on its own motion, and then they were consolidated also in the California Supreme Court. So that's just a little background about the cases themselves. I'm going to try to move this so I can see my notes here. Interestingly, last week when I received my renewal membership card from the Federalist Society, the letter recited the founding principles of the Federalist Society. One of those founding principles is that, quote, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what the law should be. Regardless of what your views about what marriage ought to be, it seems to me that it's hard to argue that the California Supreme Court did not violate that principle in the marriage cases. Instead of saying what the law is, it said what it thought the law ought to be. Before May 15th, the term marriage in California law meant the union of a man and a woman, and it always had. It meant the union of a man and a woman at common law before California became a state. It meant that in the Constitution of 1849, the original Constitution of California. In fact, in the original Constitution, there was a provision for separate property rights of husbands and wives. So the Constitution itself referred to marriage, husbands, and wives. That's what marriage meant in the Constitution. The current Constitution, Article 1, Section 21, contains that same provision. It now refers to spouses rather than husbands and wives, but when the Senate proposed that change in 1972, it said it was not making any substantive change. If there was no substantive change, then marriage in the California Constitution today still meant the union of a man and a woman. Marriage has always meant the union of a man and woman in California statutes, beginning in, I think, 1851. It was long after that before there was a statute defining or setting out marriage. But in any event, up until May 15th, in California statutes, marriage meant the union of a man or woman. California Family Code, Section 300, Section 308.5, I think it's Section 420 that said that in order to have a valid marriage, you had to declare yourself husband and wife in the presence of witnesses. So California statutes always defined marriage as a union of a man and a woman. Justice Kennard acknowledged that in her Lockyer concurrence. She said that marriage in California, the way she phrased it, had always been a heterosexual institution. Interestingly, in the marriage case's decision, the majority admitted that it would violate the separation of powers for it to redefine marriage. And then it redefined marriage. I found it very puzzling that it would make that comment and then go ahead and redefine it. Before May 15th, in California, marriage meant the union of a man and a woman. After May 15th, now the California Supreme Court said it a variety of ways. I think I counted five different ways that they articulated what marriage now means. But the essence of it was the right of an individual to establish a legally recognized family with a person of one's choice. That makes marriage today a very different institution than what it was before May 15th. Before May 15th, you could get a marriage license that had a husband and wife on it. We've been seeing in the news in the last couple of weeks that a couple in California got married, filed their marriage license. They wrote in husband and wife because they didn't want to be Party A and Party B. They wanted a marriage, and the state refused to register it because in California now, marriage is not a husband and wife. It's Party A and Party B. It seems, like I said, very hard to argue that the California Supreme Court didn't decide what the law should be rather than what the law was. There is no precedent anywhere for the majority's new definition of marriage. The parties arguing for redefining marriage never cited any authority for the definition that they wanted the court to adopt. In fact, none of the parties ever told the court what definition they wanted the court to use for marriage. Striking down the marriage laws without any relevant precedent or even a valid public policy basis was bad enough, but modifying the marriage laws to comport with the court's new definition of marriage was an extreme violation of the separation of powers under the California Constitution from my perspective. That was pure legislation. Even the other courts that have found their state marriage laws unconstitutional, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Jersey, at least acknowledged that they did not have the right to change what the laws were. They simply said they're unconstitutional, legislature, you do something. At least Massachusetts gave the legislature 6 months and they didn't bring in the new definition of marriage until after the legislature failed to act. One thing the court failed to address in its decision is when the marriage laws became unconstitutional. If something that has always existed is unconstitutional, when did it become unconstitutional? The laws didn't become unconstitutional in 1849 when the California Constitution was adopted. Marriage throughout history has always been the union of man and woman, with the exception of a few tribes here and there that are not overly civilized. And we don't look to them for other customs. I don't know why we would look to them for marriage. The marriage laws didn't become unconstitutional in 1868 when the United States adopted the 14th Amendment. The miscegenation laws became unconstitutional then. You can trace back to a point in time when they became unconstitutional because the 14th Amendment was passed to adopt racial equality. But that didn't make the marriage laws unconstitutional. The marriage laws didn't become unconstitutional in 1972 when California adopted an express privacy provision in the California Constitution. No one thought when they adopted that constitutional amendment in 1972 that they were creating constitutional protection for what was then a crime under California law. It would be, if you were going to give any effect to voter intent, to the intent of the people who adopt a law, it is very difficult to say that 1972 amendment made the marriage laws unconstitutional. The express adoption of the equal protection and due process provisions in 1974 didn't make the marriage laws unconstitutional. That simply codified what already existed under California law. The most amazing thing to me about the majority's decision in the marriage decisions was the way it dealt with public policy. The court said that public policy changes made the marriage laws unconstitutional. But Proposition 22 made that impossible. Article 2, Section 10C of the California Constitution says that the legislature cannot repeal a voter initiative. That has to mean that a public policy adopted by the voters cannot be changed by the legislature. If the legislature can change it, then it has repealed the initiative. The people determined California's public policy on marriage when they adopted Proposition 22. Under Article 2, Section 10C, that erased any contrary public policy that existed before 2000. It also prevented the legislature from adopting any contrary public policy. But the legislature immediately started trying to adopt contrary public policy, and it did that specifically with the Registered Domestic Partnership Act in 2003, which became effective in 2005. In the marriage cases, the court somehow attributed constitutional status to that legislative public policy, those legislative public policy changes, and they ruled that those public policy changes made Proposition 22 unconstitutional. I had a difficult time getting my mind around that. I know Justice George denied relying upon legislative public policy, but there's no other source of public policy. There's two sources of public policy in California, the Constitution and statutes. The marriage laws never became unconstitutional by any constitutional amendment, so there would have to be something that happened afterward to make them unconstitutional, and it didn't. Now, Justice George claimed that the legislature didn't create public policy when it adopted the Registered Domestic Partnership Act. He wrote that what the legislature did was recognized public policy. Justice Baxter was right to call him on that in the dissent. There is no esoteric body of public policy that the legislature or the courts can recognize by reading the tea leaves. It's either in the Constitution or it's in the statutes. Proposition 22 trumped any other statute. It wasn't in the Constitution. It didn't exist. Fortunately, the voters are going to have a chance to change that on November 4th. So what happens when Proposition 8 passes on November 4th? The one thing I can say for certain is that's going to engender a lot of litigation. Those who object to democracy will challenge the constitutionality of the amendment. I don't really expect the court to overturn the amendment, but if it does, I would kind of expect a Rose Byrd repeat. I don't live in California, that wouldn't be my thing, but it would surprise me if that didn't happen. There are likely to be a lot of lawsuits about the validity of the marriage licenses issued to same-sex couples between June 17th, I think it was, and November 4th. Some of those will be brought by same-sex partners who decide they didn't really want to be married. Oh, this marriage isn't valid. The Constitution's been amended. It says only marriage between a man and a woman should be valid or recognized. This isn't a valid marriage. There's likely going to be litigation in other states about the validity of a California marriage license by people who have come here, gotten a marriage license, gone back, and want it recognized even after the California Constitution is amended. And sooner or later, someone is likely to challenge the validity of all of the marriage licenses after November 4th. If someone who really wants to defend marriage is involved in that litigation representing a party, then that's apt to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's not apt to end in the California Supreme Court. Here's what I think the right outcome is of the issue of the validity of the marriage licenses that are issued between June 17th and November 4th. No same-sex couple should be recognized as married after November 4th, because that's what the amendment says. There wouldn't be any rights for a same-sex couple with a marriage license that accrue after November 4th. But all rights that are vested before November 4th would be enforceable. There is currently a valid marriage that's enforceable up until it's no longer, until the Constitution is amended, but any rights that are accrued would still be the rights of those parties. I think that makes the amendment prospective only and avoids potential problems with infringing the obligations of contracts under Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution. From my perspective, the more significant question is what happens if for some reason Proposition 8 fails. I don't think that's going to happen, but if it does, that's going to have huge social and legal consequences. the social consequences aren't going to be evident for at least a generation, if not two generations. We're always hearing this thing about, well, same-sex marriage has existed in Massachusetts for 4 years, so and the sky hasn't fallen. What's the problem? Well, you don't expect to see the social consequences of things like that in a few years. It takes a generation, maybe two. It took 40 years to see what the results of no-fault divorce are. But the legal consequences are going to be far more immediate. We're going to see attacks on churches who refuse to allow their facilities to be used for same-sex ceremonies. Those attacks will either come under a civil claim for damages under UNRU or through an attempt to remove tax exemptions. That's not just fantasy. We're seeing that already in New Jersey, where the Ocean Grove Camp Meeting Association declined to allow a lesbian couple to use a worship facility for a ceremony. The New Jersey Civil Rights Commission investigated this Methodist organization, and one of our lawyers was in court last week trying to defend their tax-exempt status. They are trying to take it away simply because they would not allow a same-sex civil union. Churches will face attacks for refusing to recognize same-sex marriages or perform same-sex marriages themselves. This will primarily be attacks on tax-exempt status, at least for the present, I would think. The rationale for attacking tax-exempt status would be the same as in the Bob Jones University case from back in the 70s, where Bob Jones University had a policy that did not allow interracial dating. The IRS says that's against social policy. We are going to take away your tax-exempt status. They lost in the U.S. Supreme Court. If same-sex marriage becomes the prevailing social norm, that could happen to churches in California. They may well lose. Pastors may eventually face prosecution simply for preaching a sermon on something like Romans 1. We saw in Sweden, we defended Pastor Aki Green, who was prosecuted and sentenced to 6 months in jail because he preached a sermon on Romans 1. The prosecutor appealed that six-month sentence because he thought that was far too short for such a heinous crime as to say that homosexual behavior is sin. You know, I don't even know how you could make that up. It's mind-boggling that could happen anywhere in the world. Fortunately, we won in the Swedish Supreme Court. But those are the kinds of things that we're going to see happening if same-sex marriage becomes the social norm. Individuals may well lose the freedom to oppose homosexual behavior. We're going to see lots more things like what happened in San Diego with the San Diego Gay Pride Parade this year, where some firefighters were forced to march in that parade in support of the gay pride movement against their will, and they filed a lawsuit against San Diego. Even if Proposition 8 passes, we're still going to have the consequences of the California Supreme Court's ruling in the marriage cases that sexual orientation is a suspect class. We're going to see nonsense like a Wheeler motion to jury strikes, like one of my guys faced Monday in San Diego in this firefighter's trial. Our side struck a juror, and the prosecutor immediately jumped up and made a Wheeler motion. He says they've struck all of the gays from the jury. And our guys are going, he was? He didn't say he was. How are you supposed to know? That's the absurdity of making a protected class out of something that you don't even know who is a member in that class. And face potential sanctions for not recognizing it. Between the UNRU Act and the court elevating sexual orientation to suspect class status, rights of conscience are in serious trouble in California. The court proved that with its decision in the North Coast Women's Care decision just a month ago, when it said that religious beliefs do not refuse justifying to give infertility treatments to a lesbian, that a Christian physician could not refuse to give that kind of a treatment. The bottom line is that Proposition 8 is crucial, But it won't solve all of the problems that were created by the marriage cases. There are a lot of other issues that are going to remain as well. As for whether this is the end of the line or whether there are more things coming, I think that although the battle for same-sex marriage has been long, the first case was filed, I think, in 1969, this is just the beginning of the impact on the religious freedoms of other people. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I was warned I probably ought to stay behind the podium here, since I understand that even though we're in about as deep blue portion of America as we can get, we in fact are inside a red bastion with inside that blue territory. So if I don't move away from here, I'm going to worry about the armor more than anything else. I'd like to start by talking a little bit about how I came to be actively involved in this as a libertarian. I'm sort of pro-choice on everything by instinct, but that was as far as it would have gone but for the fact that we had some very creative and very dedicated associates over at our firm, Shad and Arps, who came and asked if they could enlist me in helping them with an amicus brief in this case. And at that point, the Catholic Church, of course, had weighed in, the Mormons had weighed in, and what our people were intrigued about was trying to point out that religious organizations were not all of one mind on this issue. And we actually ended up filing an amicus brief that I think is responsible for increasing the length of the gay marriage opinion by 6 pages in order to list our something like 400 or 500 clients. And those included the General Synod of the United Church of Christ, the Union for Reformed Judaism, Soka Gakkai International, the Unitarian Universal Association, the California Council of Churches, and more than 400 other religions and religious leaders, all of whom not only favored same-sex marriages, but had been performing them as a matter of religious, if not legal, consecration. And basically, we set out to say, Ken Starr, don't try to hijack this issue. You're entitled to your view and the view of your clients, but you happen to represent not just Christianity, but one stripe of Christianity, and your clients ought to be totally free to consecrate whatever marriage they do or do not think is suitable. And if California starts following the Swedish Supreme Court and interfering with that, I'll be glad to show up as an amicus on the other side of any attempt to abridge the right of any church to deny recognition to any marriage of their choice. What we said, on the other hand, is there are other churches, other religions that would like to do this, and that this is such a fundamental right that the person down behind the window at City Hall ought to be issuing marriage licenses to human beings and then let each individual religion decide whether they do or do not want to also agree that that's a legitimate religion. And again, religious marriage for their purposes. And against that background, as I say, I became more actively involved. And as I was interested listening to the opening remarks today, thinking if this were 1948 rather than 2008, somebody, I'm certainly not suggesting my opponent today would have been of this stripe, but somebody, probably from out of California, would have come in and said, when did mixed-race marriages become legitimate? When did same-race marriages suddenly become unconstitutional? Because as we know, there was a day in 1948 when we had an anti-miscegenation statute in this state, and a day later the California Supreme Court struck that down. So this has happened before, and I submit Perez is largely determinative of what Ron George and the majority did here. And I think the key is that this whole dispute, depending on your point of view, is either about a single word or about the most fundamental relationship that we, at least as Americans and members of the Western world, can enjoy. And in 1948, in Perez versus Sharp, the California Supreme Court didn't say there's a right to mixed-race marriage. Rather, they said marriage is a fundamental right of all Americans, and every American has the right to marry the partner of their choice without regard to race, absent some overriding governmental interest to the contrary, and that keeping the races separate was found even in 1948 not to meet that test. Now, in the intervening 60 years, the fundamental nature of religion, of marriage, is, it seems to me, if anything, more basic and more at the core of society than it was in 1948. To be sure, I think marriage originally came up in large part not only to provide for transfer of property in an orderly way, but to provide for the legal procreation of children. Now, nobody can argue with that one, but as we've progressed into the 20th century and into the latter part of the 20th century and into the early 21st, marriage is no longer just about having children. In fact, if it were, if you think about it, only people with children should be allowed to get married. We ought to be inverting the process, and unless you've got a kitty in hand, you aren't eligible to get married, because that's the fundamental purpose of what's going on. We know that's not the case. As one who has been myself married now for close to 40 years with no intention of ever having children. However, having been able to be married, even without children, what has been the most significant event of my life and has provided for a relationship that wouldn't work under any other title. And as the Supreme Court's pointed out, that's because marriage has the meaning and connotation that it does. Domestic partner that doesn't have the same basis, and that marriage, with or without children, with or without members of the same race, has become a fundamental right of all Americans on the same level with other fundamental rights. And that's the heart of what the court did here. They relied, obviously, on Perez versus Sharp for the idea of government can't interfere, and just because it's been traditional, just because we can go back to when Jesus Christ was still a crossing guard at Hebrew school and people of the same race weren't allowed to get married, that's not good enough. There's got to be an overriding reason right now why people of the same race can't get married. And then the other significant event, I think, in between 48 and now was Griswold versus Connecticut. Well, you remember the U.S. Supreme Court held that Connecticut could not ban the right of people to use birth control devices. So we've got the U.S. Supreme Court recognizing that marriage is not about children, and it can be totally about not having children or in a childless society, and then going one step from there, I think you end up with where the majority came out in this case. Now, I want to make clear that this opinion does not say you have an obligation to marry a gay or a lesbian, any more than Perez versus Sharp said you've got an obligation to marry somebody of a different race. This is talking purely about what Isaiah Berlin, if you recall, talked about, that personal level of freedom, the right of individuals to make their own decision in what's undeniably, as I say, the key relationship in society as it goes on today. I want to leave some time, I know, for questions and discussion by other people, but want to talk just a little bit about where we go from here. As the latest I was able to find, latest poll, Prop 8, the no's are now 55%, the yes's are 38%, with only 7% undecided. So absent a whole lot of political activity on that front, I think discussion of what happens if Prop 8 passes is probably going to be academic, but it doesn't look like it's going to. And in that regard, especially being here at the Federalist Society, I find it kind of interesting that we'd be having people come in from outside of California to object to California's wanting to be a laboratory in this regard, which it seems to me is in the true federalist tradition that each state gets to choose for itself and the people of their state get to choose for themselves. And just as I would have been a little offended in 1948 if a bunch of good old boys from Mississippi were pouring money in saying, what do you mean getting rid of your anti-miscegenation statute? You're on the way to sin and non-forgiveness. Would have said, bug out. Let California make its own decision, and you do what you want in Mississippi, consistent with a federal republic that we live. And I'm having a hard time saying that without being a little bit offensive. And as long as I've gone that far and I'm still safely behind the podium, I went through college on a debate scholarship, which meant that for a whole year, 1 hour we took one side of a topic, and the next hour we took the other side, which is a pretty good education in terms of finding out there are two sides to most questions. And I've been doing litigation for the 41 years since, as a plaintiff sometimes, as a defendant otherwise, and I think I'm pretty good at seeing two sides to a question. I am totally conflicted on abortion. I can't make up my mind one way or another there. This is an exception to that rule. I submit gay marriage is to the 21st century what slavery was to the 19th century, and that civilized people in the near future and the distant future are going to be looking back saying, how could otherwise intelligent, rational human beings have taken the view they did, in the same way that I think we now look back on 1948 in terms of how could people have been so backward-oriented, looking only in their rearview mirror and failing to realize where we've come. And particularly in terms of those of you who are on the other side, don't you have something better to do with your life? There's a lot of harm out there with people inflicting wrong on other people. Abortion, I mean, we can call that murder if we want, but as a Federalist, as a Libertarian, whatever, I think we all would agree with Ronald Reagan's get government off our back. And how about starting with the bedroom and the most personal relationship and getting them out of there as a starter? How are any of us adversely impacted because other people want to enjoy the same fundamental relationship that we do? Okay. It took longer than I thought. I thought she'd rush the podium directly. Okay.
So, thank you. And I will keep your name when I am brought to court for because they've already begun in San Francisco, anecdotally speaking, someone said, why do you oppose homosexual marriage? And it's not that I oppose homosexual marriage. I oppose marriage not being defined as between one man and one woman. I also oppose three people getting married. This this decision actually leaves a vacant warehouse-sized door to go through and allow any type of union between multiple partners, because under equal protection, I think you'll agree. Number one. Number two, so this guy said to me, I said, I think children deserve a mother and a father. This is an adult-centered argument. You speak about a childless society. A childless society will cease to exist. We need our children. Children need a mother and a father. When I said that, I was told, he practically spit in my face and called me an effing bigot. I didn't say I was against homosexual people getting married. I said I thought that children deserve a mother and a father. It was a very neutral statement. But the fact is, this decision, because of its ruling on strict scrutiny, has made that a statement of bigotry. And we will see that. And although you say, how are we impacted? We already see what it's like for kids not to have a father. I work at the SF Dental. I work volunteering in the emergency room. And so all those kids come in that have no father, come in with bullet wounds and everything like that. This decision is saying that kids actually can't have a mother either, that a mother is not an important integral part, because parents, you just need two parents, two loving parents. So the impact of children not growing up with their mother is going to be massive.
Not sure there was a question in there,
but okay. Let me. This is why to Why would I spend my time? Okay. I not only will spend my time, I'll spend my last dime.
Okay.
To defend the rights of children, fundamentally to have a mother and a father. Okay.
Well, other than that, I'd like Glenn to
come out as well. Okay, let me just deal with that. I guess under that analysis, that you don't mind having adopted children of gay or lesbian couples somehow having a secondary status because they're not part of a true marriage or family, or perhaps you want to go even further and say gay and lesbian couples should not be allowed to adopt, and that children would really be better off in an orphanage or a foster home rather than being in a true family environment, because you can't have both a mother and a father. It's better they don't have either one in an orphanage. Everything's relative in life. Glenn, I'm sure you're not going to find too much to argue with that, but I'll give you a chance to respond to that.
Sure, you were finished. If you want to finish your comments, I don't want to interrupt before you're done.
No, that's fine. We'll give you a chance. And as I say, I thought I'd be provoking. Thought I'd take longer than this. I must be losing my talent in my old age. So, thank you very much. And for those of you who were inclined to say things that didn't.
There is zero research showing what happens when children grow up in a home when children grow up in a home raised by two men from birth or two women from birth. Zero. There's research about points in time, but there's no research comparing children raised by two men with children raised by two women with children raised by a mom and a dad. And I've already got a question.
One, I want to point out to you and to the popular pro-marriage forces that I find the lack of attention to men's issues in any of your briefs, particularly given the separatist, neo-exterminationist, and the standard which pervades this decision all the way from Michael H. to Dawn cases, the Turkey-based trio of cases, which essentially eliminates biological fathers as beings in the law. I think you've ignored some very valid arguments that could have bolstered your case, and I don't know why. As far as the radical homosexual activists, my question is for the future. I believe that the Supreme Court, quoted the Canadian Supreme Court, where they have banished and fined individuals who said you may never speak of homosexuality again for daring to object to this event. If I were to practice in a California court, and I'm looking towards the future. Now, even if the Constitution is, even if the citizens overturn this ruling, we still have the legacy of it as a strict scrutiny. The question is practice in court. And the opposing counsel is a woman, say, someone who abuses steroids and who pretends to be a man. Do I have to pretend that, in order to degrade myself and other men, that this steroid-abusing woman is a man? Or will I be sentenced to jail for contempt or hate crime for refusing to denigrate myself
and other men? Thank you. Very smart issues.
And I'm not sure that I have an answer to that other than, yeah, probably.
I was very interested. I think you gentlemen did a great job of showing the differences both in psyche, in sort of culture, in legal arguments, in sort of process, thinking process underlying the minority and majority opinions. I was interested in something that Mr. Kennedy said when I was in law school. It was still illegal. Certain behaviors were legal. There was a poverty law that hadn't been struck down. And in the discussion of Roe versus Wade, you know how in cases there's always questions and notes at the back? One of the things it said is it said actually that you could make a much stronger argument for overturning the poverty laws than overturning the abortion laws, because there's at least arguably a life involved in the abortion situation where there was nothing comparable to that in the other situation. So I think those are arguments that have been recognized for a long time. Well, I have a question. Given that it's not 1948, and California law already, we know that large groups of same-sex couples are living together, and we allow them to adopt children and so forth, doesn't there need to be some mechanism for regulating what happens when those relationships break up as human relationships sometimes do, no matter what orientation there is.
Well, certainly the registered domestic partnership laws do that. But that does raise a question that Mr. Kennedy raised, is whether perhaps we would think that same-sex couples ought not adopt. And if children deserve a mom and a dad, then the law should not be encouraging same-sex couples to adopt. You know, you can always come up with the extreme situation where you've got a child that is that no one wants to adopt, and there's someone who's willing to. Is the child better off being adopted by somebody who will love them rather than by nobody? It's kind of hard to argue that they wouldn't be. But we're not talking about the extreme situations. We're talking about things like the two men from San Francisco who sued a client of mine because my client would not post their potential adoptive profile on the website for a newborn child. And I looked at that and I said, oh, this is easy. There's no personal jurisdiction to violate the interstate commerce law to cause to apply California law to Arizona, choice of law issues, it'd be Arizona law, it's an Arizona business, and I couldn't get the case dismissed. We eventually ended up settling the case because in San Francisco, I could not get that case dismissed. I was astonished. But that's the kind of thing. The major issue is, what about the newborns? Do we really want to encourage parents to do this social science experiment on kids when we don't know what the outcomes are going to be? The general research shows that children do best with their own mom and dad who are married. Yes, there is research by those who are performing it for the purpose of proving that same-sex parenting is okay, that says that all you need are two loving parents. I'm a little more inclined to go with the research that didn't have a political purpose when it was done. So,
yes, perhaps in the libertarian wing of thought over here, but why can't I marry both a man and a woman now? And I raise this for both speakers, because I think it goes to the argument that both of you have made in different ways. Why can't I marry both a man and a woman?
Well, the Supreme Court, in a footnote, I think, pointed to cases that have upheld the polygamy laws, and I looked at that and almost laughed. Those cases are not as strong as the case law we had in favor of marriage as a union of a man and a woman. And those cases could easily fall. I think that polygamy is a much easier argument to make. Number one, polygamy has existed from the dawn of time. And by the way, so has interracial marriage. Interracial marriage was not a new thing in 1948. It was a new thing to California, although the California Supreme Court had recognized an interracial marriage in 1875, Pearson v. Pearson. But interracial marriage has always existed. Moses' sister criticized him because he married a black woman. You can read about that in the Bible. I mean, interracial marriage is as old as the Bible. Same-sex marriage is not. So you were asking that to both of us. I don't know if Mr. Kennedy would like to respond to that.
I can't read that. That's three things.
Glad to distribute copies of our amicus brief that traces same-sex marriage back to the Greeks. And it continued, I won't bore you with complete recitation, but that's our historical presentation that it has existed continuously since substantially before the Bible. Beyond that, on the man and the woman, that was an intriguing question. My guess as a practicing lawyer is that the polygamy laws would come into effect there and bar it. On the other hand, from a true libertarian standpoint, I can't quarrel with that proposition. I don't see how you're damaging or harming me in any way with that three-way relationship, and particularly if you've decided you're going to have a relationship with those two people, whether it's approved by the state or not. I think we'd probably all be better off if we had an orderly progression of property and agreed with the children of that three-way relationship. We're all legitimized. So, I don't see what harm that would do. I think they have a hard time getting over the border.
That takes us back to the position of the minority here, at least in the Supreme Court case. It's what parade of horribles would follow from having a marriage if I choose to marry both a man and a woman? I have a woman and a man to raise my children, or his children,
I have a man go to the opera with because my wife doesn't like the opera.
Well, like I say, I think that's a lot easier to argue for than same-sex marriages. I mean, there's a lot of precedent for that. And, you know, I've read the history of the same-sex marriage as well. And the articles by Boswell and by guy with case for same-sex marriage. It's interesting the different ways they use the rhetoric. It was never recognized as marriage. Even in Africa, the female marriages in Africa were not a sexual relationship. That was a wealthy woman who could hire someone to come in and take care of her children. It was a very different thing than what the same-sex marriages are today.
Yeah, I guess the thing I resent, I find myself a libertarian, sympathetic to people who tend to relate. What outrages me is where, you know, Proposition 22 was so recently passed, and they can declare it so easily to, you know, to impose their agenda, and that's really, that really bothers me a lot. And is it Mr. Kennedy over there? Can you comment on that? And you didn't really go into the legal stuff that much. And how could it possibly be 6 years later? How could public policy be declared? It just boggles the mind. The arrogance of the justice is what's really bothering.
I understand your perspective. I think the answer is it wouldn't have made any difference if the California anti-miscegenation statute had been passed in 1942 or 1872 and came up for review in 1948. The question is, does it violate a fundamental human right? And I think that case made clear, and this one does too, a deprivation of human liberties doesn't get an escape hatch because it's been around for a long time. Enforces that it doesn't have a particular tradition. But I understand your outrage. I think if you think about it, if something's wrong in the insurance field, it's go to the Roseburg Supreme Court with however many of those cases. It didn't take the dictation court more than 4 or 5 years to turn them over. I don't see why you'd be upset about the length of it. It's wrong, and I already correct.
Yeah, is your view on that, the 14th Amendment, is the difference between...
It's a huge difference. The miscegenation laws became unconstitutional in 1868. It's easy to point to a definite time when they became unconstitutional. I've yet to hear someone tell me a point in time when the marriage laws became unconstitutional. Another significant difference, the 1948 miscegenation case is federal law. That case was based on the federal constitution, not the California constitution. It really disappointed me that Justice George referred to that case as California law, talked about it as California constitutional law. That is U.S. constitutional law. There was no California basis. The miscegenation laws did not violate the California Constitution in 1948. They violated the federal constitution. If there was an interesting, I don't remember, I think it was a footnote in Justice Pirelli's concurring decision in the Court of Appeal that was almost a quotation from my brief that said, I can imagine that the outcome in Perez would have been very different if it had been a white man and a black man who were applying for a marriage license. It would have been very different.
I think in the interest of people getting back to their offices, we should close the formal question and answer session. But I'm sure our speakers will hang around for a little while, so I know there are other good questions out there. Thank you all for coming. I want to thank all the law students here. We have UC Davis and San Joaquin and Hastings. No goals these out of play, but we'll work on that. So thank you all for coming. Be sure to get your CLE sometime. We hope to see you at some other events. Thank you.